All right, everybody, welcome to Sequelitis.
Welcome to Sequelitis.
And I don't know about you guys, but I'm ready to bust some ghosts today.
I am ready to bust some Lady Ghostbusters after seeing that movie. Just want to say real quick, I know it's been a little while since we put out one of these. I've been on the road for a while. If you care about what I've been doing, you can just look on Instagram. It's at Big Taste Grillmaster, and that's all I'll say about that. Check it out if you want.
I will have to check that out. I didn't even have that handle. I didn't even know about that. I knew about the other handles that you have, your more personal ones.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I still have my Twitter, but like I'm suspended out of my Facebook, and somehow that's got me suspended out of my my personal Instagram account, which I had to set to private. But I'm kind of like a spokesperson for a company right now, and so that's why I don't want a lot of my personal stuff connected to my actual name. Because then, you know, maybe it'll create a problem. Just erring on the side of caution.
It definitely makes sense. Makes sense. So you saw Ghostbusters win yesterday?
I went and watched Ghostbusters on Thursday. First of all, I'll just state flat out, I was entertained by the film. I laughed at the film. I didn't think it was that great. But if I had to rank it in the pantheon of Ghostbusters films, this is the second best Ghostbusters film made. It had one of the worst marketing campaigns I've seen for any major blockbuster film to be released in my lifetime. It's absolutely terrible. It does the film a huge disservice. And it's also very misleading because I remember the initial trailer that I saw posited as sort of a... sort of a sequel to earlier Ghostbuster films, as opposed to a complete and total reboot of the franchise.
Yeah, it made it sound like it was a sequel. That was very bizarre.
Yeah,
I don't know why they would do that.
And the frustrating thing about that was they could have easily made it a sequel. It would have fit right in had they tried to shoehorn it in that way, because they did have all three. Living cast members from the original Ghostbusters films make cameos, but I mean, maybe the only way to convince Bill Murray to come back was by having him play a different character and not reprising his role as Dr. Peter Venkman.
Well, you know, I've heard so many different accounts of what the hang-ups are for Ghostbusters 3, and I feel like it gets hung on Bill Murray kind of unfairly. Like, I don't know if I totally believe that he was really, like, the holdout issue for it. I mean, maybe he was, but, I mean, a cameo is not a good thing. Like, it's not a good look to have a cameo in a movie. Cameos suck, essentially. And I think Bill Murray, like, did himself a pretty big disservice with his cameo in this movie completely.
Yeah, I mean...
Because it was...
Bill Murray
is... It was
a
terrible character.
Bill Murray is his best if he's going to do a cameo. He's his best if he's playing himself in the cameo and not playing some other character. And, you know, the strongest argument for that is his cameo in Zombieland. He's making an appearance as Bill Murray, as... you know, as seen in Ghostbusters, Bill Murray, and that's
he also cameos himself in Coffee and Cigarettes, the Jim Jarmusch flick, and where the RZA's like, motherfucker, Bill Murray,
which now he's immortalized as a meme as motherfucking Bill Murray.
Yeah, that's from that movie.
Yeah, but. Yeah, it's you've got this weird film, and it's one of those things where I kind of made a comment about it. You know, I said in 1984, a film titled Ghostbusters was released with the goal to make as much money at the box office as possible. In 2016, a film titled Ghostbusters was released with the goal of making as much money at the box office as possible. And that's how Hollywood works. I know a lot of people are like, oh, well, you can't do this. Like, you know, this is some sort of crime. And this is not like even talking about the controversy of having a female cast, which I think is kind of a ridiculous controversy. In a few years, it won't even matter. Everyone will kind of have forgotten about that completely. But, you know, people are acting like it's some sort of like sacred piece that you can't. you know, try to monetize. But the thing is it was only created in the first place, you know, to monetize an idea and to monetize the talents of the people involved with making it. Like, that was always the goal.
I don't know if I totally agree with all that, because, you know, Sequelitis has been around forever, and even in 1984 they probably would have rather have made, you know, the sequel to something else instead of Ghostbusters. And, you know, these dudes had to go in there and prove their case and, you know, write this movie and get people interested and, you know, find money for it. I don't know if I totally agree that.
Yeah, but you can agree with this. They didn't make Ghostbusters expect, like saying, like, we don't care if we make any money or if nobody watches this. We have to make this movie. We don't care about making any money. You agree that nobody involved in the production said that, right?
Yeah, I do agree that the Columbia Pictures that paid for it wanted to make the money back on their investment.
Yeah, and Ivan Reitman and Harold Ramis and everybody involved with the making of the film, you know, had the goal of, like, hey, we want this to be a successful film. We want people... I mean, the thing is for it to be a successful film, people have to like it. The more people like it, the more successful it's going to end up being. So it's not like they're try and make a total shitty movie, and we just want to dupe as many people out of their money as possible. That wasn't the goal with any of these films. You could try to make the argument that maybe with Ghostbusters 2, you know, that it was a cynical cash grab. But even with that, like, they did still try to do things. They did try to find something, you know, original with the story without completely doing something new and original. But, you know, just like the 1984 movie, just like the 2016 movie, that movie was made with the goal of trying to make money.
Yeah, but I think the big differential here is that in 1984... the idea for Ghostbusters and the movie of Ghostbusters was like this totally, essentially original thing. I mean, I know there was a cartoon even before that movie came out. There was a cartoon with the same title to it. But the idea of it and the approach to it and the way that it was like in the real world, you know, these ghosts are in the real world. You know, we understand that ghosts can exist fictionally in movies, but it was portrayed in this as if it was the real world. And there were ghosts in the real world, and how could it scientifically be accurate that they were there? And it was an original take on it, you know, having comedians in there instead of like action heroes. It was just a totally new, totally different take. And what they're doing with this is they're just trying to recapture that same lightning in a bottle. You know, instead of taking these talented screenwriters, these talented actors, these talented directors, and letting them do some new original project that can go off and earn a boatload of money, they want to strap them down to the exact same old thing that worked in the past. And what made it work in the past was that it was new and original, not that it was a copy of something else.
Yeah, but...
And that's... But I mean, that's what sequelitis is all about. That's why it's a disease that must be cured.
but in reality, you're not going to have that happen so long as people will still have nostalgia for films that they watched before and are still going to gravitate toward known properties. And that kind of exposes both, you know, the fortune of the original film and the flaw of this film is that, you know, what worked so well in the first film was you did have someone take kind of an original approach. I mean, you've actually, there is, you know, the cartoon Ghostbusters was based on an old film, I think an old black and white film called Ghostbusters, or it might have been a series. But it was about two guys and an ape, and they have like some kind of a crazy car, and they go around, you know, using like a vacuum cleaner to catch ghosts. And I have no idea how much of an inspiration that series was on the making of the original Ghostbusters movie. But to that point, it wasn't a familiar property in people's minds. Like, there wasn't a mass appeal film that had been released to the public that said, like, hey, what if you had four kind of blue collar guys who were ghost exterminators, and it was done as a comedy with science fiction elements to it. So when that came out in 1984, that was a fresh and an original idea for most people. And then it also had the benefit of having some cutting-edge special effects that to this day stand up. Most of the special effects look really good. Like, the frickin' Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in that movie looks awesome. Like, it's such a great effect. There's some stuff that looks kind of a little hokey and silly, but it blends in so well with the tone of the film that it works. So when you fast forward, you know, and people that grew up watching that film like you and I, you know, have now seen, you know, all of the advances in special effects, and we're so familiar with that story, and it's become iconic and legendary. It's created its own, you know, very fondly held legacy. When you try to duplicate that idea right away from the start, even if you said, yeah, we're going to bring back all three, you know, surviving cast members, and we're going to do this film again, people are already starting to roll their eyes. And then when
I don't think a sequel is the right idea either. I think the property is more or less like dead.
Yeah. And the other thing that I say too is, like, you know, there have been some people, and this is one of the dumber arguments I've heard about this film. But, you know, people were attacking it on, you know, the idea that it had an all-female lead cast, which, if that's what they want to do and if they can make it work, fine. Who cares? You know, but people were just like, well, why can't make an all-male lead cast remake of Ghostbusters? They did that. They did that in frickin' 1991. It was called Ghostbusters 2. It sucked. You know, if somebody likes that film, yeah, I'm sorry. If you go back and you watch it and you're objective about it, it sucks. All it does is it rehashes the plot of the first film, and it's inferior. It's an inferior product. And even compared to this new remake, it's inferior to that, just because you do have some things that I think worked so much better in this film than worked in, you know, the remake of Ghostbusters called Ghostbusters 2.
Well, yeah, it's just the freshness of it. It was like all the freshness was completely gone with Ghostbusters 2. It was like every single piece of it was something that you had seen before. And even though you liked it the first time, it's just that sense that I've already seen this just was obnoxious.
Yeah. So let's talk more about this actual film, and kind of to speak to the discussion that you and I had before. You know, what we do with Sequelitis is not so much do reviews of films as we will actually kind of like talk about the idea of a property, kind of break that down, talk about the things that we like that we thought worked really well. And then in most cases, because, you know, Sequelitis has a negative connotation, we talk about the things that didn't work so well. And then we go on to pitch alternative ideas that we think might have worked better. Is that a fair statement, you think?
Yeah, I think it's about fair. You know, I think it's hard to nail down exactly what Sequelitis is in any kind of a paragraph, but, you know, it's basically just dissecting something and trying to understand why it worked before, why it isn't working now. Because I think making a good sequel is an amazing art that really takes talented people. And, like, not a lot of sequels are good movies. You know, that's why when you find a movie like Empire Strikes Back, or Indiana Jones 2, that's just another good movie in the series. Or, like, I like the old Star Trek movies, starting with number 2. So it's like, you make Star Trek 2, you make Star Trek 3, Star Trek 4, they keep being good, they're good. Essentially, 3's a little not so good. But, you know, it's an art form. Back to the Future, you make some good sequels, it's incredible. It's like, it's hard to do because you're trying to recapture the same magic in a bottle, but you're also trying to recalculate the little things that didn't work from the original.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible art form, and I do appreciate it.
I mean, it's kind of like trying to make a meal out of leftovers. You have to kind of take the ingredients that worked so well and figure out a way to utilize them in a dish that's going to be as good as the original was. And sometimes if you're just like, we'll just reheat the same thing and serve it, it's like, I mean, it might have been good the night before, but, you know, tonight there's no way it's going to be as good tonight as it was when it was first served.
Well, it's not exactly like leftovers. It's more like you're trying to make the same dish you made last night, but you don't have the same ingredients anymore. It's like,
well, I mean,
you know, anything could be in there.
You had as many of the same ingredients in Ghostbusters 2 as you did for Ghostbusters 1, but, you know,
yeah,
you did make the mistake
leftovers
of saying, I'm going to take the exact same ingredients and then I'm just going to remake the same dish and serve it to you and hope that you think, like, oh, this new dish is great, you know, instead of saying, yeah, this new dish is kind of like the first one. It's just not as good.
Yeah, it is like that, but if you were like already still full from having the first meal, you know, but like
no, in 1991 people were hungry for more. I mean, people have been hungry for more Ghostbusters for 30 fucking years, you know. It's crazy.
In 1991, but you're talking about watching Ghostbusters 1 and then 5 minutes later watching Ghostbusters 2, you know, with the home video market, which is pretty old at this point.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, they didn't always have a home video market.
Yeah.
And, you know, before the 80s, it made more sense to make a sequel because it was like, here's that same movie that you've seen before, but, you know, the sequel to it, and you can go to the theaters and you can see it in a world where you couldn't see it at all. Like, you couldn't see it on TV, you couldn't see it, you couldn't buy it. And, you know, so it was just, it came from a different world. And now that we live in this world where you could just go watch the original 1984 Ghostbusters, you know, most people are happy to go out and purchase a ticket to see it remade. Like they enjoy the refreshness of it.
Yeah, I mean,
or they, at least they expect to.
Well, and that's the thing, is you can't sit there. I mean, if you're really talented and you're really up to the challenge, you can sit there and make a sequel or a follow-up to a story that tries to find a way to utilize the fact that someone can watch one, and then even though the next one didn't come out for another 30 years, right now people can watch one and then immediately start up the next one and kind of have them flow together, right, like that. But yeah, that adds a whole other element of difficulty that, I mean, I think a lot of people, even if you tried it in this case, maybe they're not up to the task, because it requires a lot of thoughtfulness, a lot of patience, and a lot of willingness to try something a little bit risky that might not exactly pay off the way that you're expecting it to. But, you know, all that aside, let me just say this with about this film, is that, you know, what really plagues this film, I think what really is its, you know, main flaw, is the fact that it just tries to do the same thing that pretty much every other film, every other, you know, box office tentpole movie tries to do, which is, it starts off, you know, sometimes these movies start off really strong, and this one did, certainly, where it introduces the characters, the concept, the world that they're in. It kind of constructs all that in sort of a seamless way to where, like, it draws the audience in. It allows you to kind of get comfortable and know kind of like how the rules work and what to expect. And then once it gets to the second act, everything just becomes this mad dash to get to the big over-the-top spectacle that is the finale of the movie. And, you know, to go to another kind of soft reboot, remake of a popular film that also came out this summer, I saw Independence Day Regurgitation, and, you know, that movie did the exact same thing. It introduced the world, it caught you up on all the characters, because it really tried to be more of a sequel rather than just a complete remake, which is what...
Well, but in the defense of Independence Day, if I may, like, it kind of invented that ending, that tentpole ending.
Yeah, but that was also a big, epic site. I mean, like, it had to do something like that. That was an alien invasion movie, and it kind of had to take the War of the Worlds conceit and then say, like, okay, you know, rather than have an intellectual ending, what's a big, loud, flashy ending that we can have, you know, and something that kind of creates some tension. I mean, as many flaws as the original Independence Day had, it really did. It's such a perfect summer blockbuster movie. Like, it took what Spielberg started with Jaws, and it really just updated that and kind of brought us into the modern world that we have now, where it combines, like, these great special effects and all this, like, over-the-top action with some just really fucking dopey one-liners that were made so popular by 80s and 90s action films. You know, Independence Day is the perfect big dumb action sci-fi summer movie. It's perfect for what it is. It's not a great film by any stretch of the imagination. It's not even really that well made of a film or well written. You know, all the characters are pretty much two-dimensional, but it's exactly what you expect it to be. It pays off in every way that it should pay off. And I think what's happened is now you get a lot of summer movies that are just like, they're like, all right, all we have to do is just make sure that we meet expectations rather than exceed expectations. And that's the difference between original Ghostbusters and Lady Ghostbusters. Is original Ghostbusters so far exceeded expectations. That's what made it so goddamn great. And a lot of that's due to the cast members, and a lot of that's due just to how tight so many things were with how the movie was filmed, was edited, was just constructed, the way that the special effects blend in so well and enhance the story. You don't get the sense like you did with the Lucas Star Wars prequels, where you're like, everyone's standing in front of a fucking green screen and reacting to, you know, a fucking paper plate on the end of a stick. Like this was something where you got the sense that there was some real weight to the ghosts that, you know, weren't there when they made it, but, you know, it blends in. There wasn't really a fucking 300-foot-tall marshmallow man walking around New York City, but every single time it takes a step in Ghostbusters, you feel the weight of the ground shaking. On Red Letter Media, they were talking about original Ghostbusters, and they brought up something that I had just kind of taken for granted, but the fact that they spent the time and the money at, kind of toward the climax of the film, when the ground cracks open and it kind of sucks in the Ghostbusters vehicle, you know, they spent the time and the money to actually create that effect. And not only that, but they blended in so well that unless you're thinking about it, you don't notice that that scene is shot on a stage rather than an actual New York street. It looks authentic. And, you know, again, that goes back to what I was saying before of you have a summer blockbuster movie that exceeds expectations. And that is going to be the biggest difference between original Ghostbusters and Lady Ghostbusters. You know, Lady Ghostbusters was all just about like, okay, we have to have this big, you know, visual spectacle at the end of the film, but we have to have the Ghostbusters manage to like come out on top and, you know, save the day at the end. That has to happen. And so there's no sort of tension. There's no concern of like, oh, what's going to happen? Is somebody going to die? Are we going to lose somebody? And instead you just get something that's just kind of flat and it lacks any sort of like emotional punch. It just doesn't draw you in because it's not trying to exceed your expectations. It's not trying to surprise you in any way. It's not trying to touch you in any way. It's just merely trying to be something for you to look at and to be dazzled by and briefly distracted before you get up and you toss your 3D glasses in the bucket on your way out the door.
Well, can I just squeeze a word in here, if I may?
Yeah, I went off on kind of a rant there.
Yeah, for me, I was sort of in the camp that was like mildly offended about the idea of there being like an all-girl reboot. I wasn't like super offended by it, but I was just kind of like scratching my head, like not that a Seth Rogen, you know, Seth, who's the other guy that's always in Seth Rogen's movies?
James Franco.
Yeah.
Danny McBride. Well, I was thinking Channing Tatum. Or
who's the one from 21 Jump Street? Yeah, Jonah Hill. That's what I was thinking. Like I don't think that a Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill version was the answer either. It's not that I'm saying that. But I was just kind of like scratching my head saying, you know, was the original one so like sexist? And like was that sort of the underlying tone of it, that it was just such a misogynistic, shitty movie that you need to come in and kind of correct it? And I was mildly offended by it, but then when I saw it, that totally went away. I enjoyed the lady version of it. I liked the cast for the most part. I feel like any flaws with it was just the idea that they, you know, they're trying to create that, they're trying to capture that lightning in a bottle, and it's hard to capture. And, you know, I think you could take this, what they made, and you could make a sequel to it and you could make it better. But is it going to be a big enough hit to where that is really a necessity or not? That's kind of the question at this point.
Yeah, well, you know, if I can go on another little mini rant kind of talking about people's sure. reaction to the decision to make it a female cast. You know, I think if you're kind of going like, oh, well, you know, they're trying to lash back at the Ghostbusters for being sexist and having an all male cast. That's not what their intentions were at all. I can say that definitively. There's nothing about the careers of anybody involved, especially with Melissa McCarthy and Paul Feig. You know, two people that have worked very, very well together in the past, to suggest that that's what their goal was. It doesn't make any sense why you would make a movie starting from that conceit. But to kind of address, like, the way people are like, oh, well, why does it have to be an all-female cast? I've got to say, if you're offended by the fact that they decided to do an all-female cast, and they cast very funny, some of the funniest women in Hollywood today to be in this movie, you know, and this is the first time all four of those actresses have worked together. But if you're offended by that, but you're not offended by the fact that Hollywood does really go out of its way to exclude women and minorities as much as possible. And as someone who's lived and worked in Hollywood and knows people that have very good jobs in Hollywood, I can tell you this is 100% true. There are so many times where either a conscious or an unconscious decision is made that does exclude women or does exclude people of color, minorities, people who are immigrants, people from different backgrounds. And that's because Hollywood is not this like massively liberal organization that is trying to force liberal views down America's throat. Hollywood is an organization that is fucking scared to death of offending people, you know, in middle America, in the flyover states, in the red states, to the point to where you have people that are afraid to express who they are, whether it be sexually, whether it be certain ideas that they have. They can't even in their personal lives express themselves because they're so worried about how that would affect their jobs. Because if a majority of people in America are like, oh, you know what, like, he's gay, fuck him, I don't like him anymore, that they don't come out and say that they're gay. They don't live freely as the person that they are because they want to keep up this illusion that, you know, most middle Americans have of them. And so, you know, you've got to look at a huge organization like that, that has so much influence over the way that we look at ourselves as, you know, citizens of the United States. You know, it's exclusionary to a lot of people, and that is just to kind of keep up this core. I mean, there's a reason why there are people of color that boycotted the Oscars. It's a real thing. And if you think it's not a real thing, or if you're bothered by movies that recast, you know, a man as a woman, or a white person as a person of color, like, fuck you. You're part of the problem. You're not someone who's being bold and courageous by saying, like, oh, I'm going to stand up to, you know, PC culture. Like, that's ridiculous. You know, I realize, like, some people with PC culture can be ridiculous, but they're not the people that are making the world a worse place by being oppressive. PC culture has never been about oppression. PC culture has always been about, you know, lashing back against people who have been part of the oppressors. And if you want to say that they've gone too far sometimes, certainly, I'll give you that. But it's never been to the point to where people's lives have been ruined or destroyed, or someone's been forced to live a shitty life, you know, because they were not, you know, the primary, you know, gender and race that everyone kind of looks up to and aspires to be. I mean, and if you want to sit there and say, like, well, what evidence do you have of this? Go back and look over the history of Hollywood and who has been your hero protagonist in most movies. And 70-80% of the time, it's a white male protagonist. You know, time and time again, in some of the most iconic movies,
like how,
you can look back and say, white male protagonist. So if that's...
I like how you ask yourself the questions and then you answer them, you know? That's funny to me.
Yeah, but at least I'm not doing like, oh, you know what? Google it. But I can say, like, you can go back and look. I mean, Dr. Peter Venkman, Indiana Jones, Luke Skywalker. Like, you have these... I mean, even with Jaws, like, it was.
Well, I feel like there is some point to people being like mildly offended about an all lady remake of it. Like, I'm no longer in the camp that's offended because now I've actually seen the movie.
Yeah, but make that
and
make
even
sense
when
to
I
me.
Was offended, it was mildly. It was only the most mildly offensiveness. But I think the problem with it is that you're being exclusionary in the opposite direction. You know, you're going to preach about how, you know, everyone should be represented, you know, so I think the logical thing to do would be have a multicultural, multi-gender, multi everything cast. You know, that's the answer to diversity, but you take it in the complete opposite direction.
You do have that because you have males in supporting roles in this movie. You have Leslie Jones, a black woman, as one of your main cast members. I mean, you do have diversity in this movie. This movie wasn't strictly exclusionary. This movie didn't even tackle women issues at all. Like, there's never like a discussion of like, oh, well, being a woman is like this, you know, like there wasn't period talk. There wasn't motherhood talk, childbirth talk. I mean, you had a vague allusion to the fact that Holtzman might have been a lesbian, which didn't play in the plot at all. Like, there wasn't even stuff about dating or relationships.
After seeing the movie, I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it was just the before you see the movie, just the kind of effect that it has on your brain. It's like, you know, are we not going to diversify things? We're just going to say, oh, here's the black Ghostbusters, here's the girl Ghostbusters.
Yeah, but if you're not asking that question,
James Bond, here's female James Bond.
Yeah, if you're not asking that question when it comes to movies like The Expendables, like there's a man's movie for man starring man being men. Like, if you're not asking yourself that diversity question about those movies, but you are about Lady Ghostbusters, fuck you, man. Like. Kill yourself because we don't need you. Like you're not making things better.
Yeah, well, I'm assuming you're talking to some other you that's not me, but I hear what you're saying. I don't like The Expendables.
Yeah, people.
I would like to see The Expendables deleted off the face of the earth.
I mean, we have a whole history of cinema that is all about satisfying the male power fantasy, the white male power fantasy. And I mean, we've talked about this in podcasts in the past. I mean, if you want the perfect example of the white male power fantasy in America, that stereotype, go on YouTube and look up the Thomas Jane Punisher video. What was that one called?
Dirty Laundry.
Dirty Laundry. Go look that up on YouTube. That is such just. To me, it's offensive. Some people might not be bothered by it, but I'm bothered by it because
I was offended by it as well.
White male Christian, you know, gun loving Texas Republican fucking fantasy.
Yeah, it is,
and it's to a T, to a freaking T, dude.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I don't. I'm not really arguing the point of the other side. So,
no, and I know you're not, and I'm not talking to you. I mean, because
yeah, no, I know.
I mean, you and I come from a very similar place. We both grew up in rural Texas. We've both seen it, and we both rejected this sort of like, you know, honky tonk like Texas tough guy, you know, gun toting, Bible thumping Republican. Like we're not into that at all. Even though we look like two white guys, you know. It's just something that doesn't appeal to us, and it doesn't appeal to us for very obvious reasons, you know. There's just so many more benefits to being progressive and being open-minded and embracing different ideas no matter where they come from and embracing diversity as opposed to just being like, you know, well, if he ain't look like me and he ain't go to church with me, fuck him. You know, I'm going to hang out with Timmy. He got a good job.
Well, let's go back to the subject of Ghostbusters if we can for just a second.
I've gotten off on a tangent, so you take the reins.
Yeah, well, let me just say that I don't know. I wasn't truly offended by the idea of a whole women's Ghostbusters, but it definitely got me scratching my head, and I was going to see the movie and sort of see where it kind of fell, where the whole thing fell at. And ultimately, the fact that they were all ladies was probably the best part of it, to tell you the truth. The worst part of it was when they strayed too far away from what it is to be a Ghostbuster, and when they strayed too far away from how to tell a good story, and especially when they strayed way too close to the traditional summer blockbuster ending where, you know, you have to have at least 200, 300, 400 bad guys all come out. It's like this the whole city gets destroyed. It's this big fight in Manhattan. I mean, how many movies have had that climax at this point? It's getting ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, there's one movie recently that did it really, really well, and that was Iron Man 3, and it's because it's your boy, Shane Black, coming in there, and just saying, like, look, everybody stand back. This is how it's done. You know, I know I'm a white male in Hollywood, but, you know, I'm also very good at my job.
A lot of people didn't like that movie. I liked it, though.
A lot of people didn't like that movie, but they liked it for a dumb reason. They didn't like the movie because they were like, well, that's not the Mandarin that I know. And it's like, well, I mean, it's a Hollywood film. If you want the same Mandarin that you're used to, go back and reread the comic books. But, you know, you're watching a film here, and here's somebody taking a new and different take on it. And if it didn't work for you, that's fine. It didn't work for you. But, you know, for me, like, I didn't think it was better than the first Iron Man movie, but it did things in a way that it was like, okay, you know what? Like, this works. This whole thing works. You know, but for this movie, yeah, it was just like, hey, here's an over-the-top visual spectacle that doesn't do anything to give you the sense that there's real consequences to this. And therefore, it kind of betrays the whole setup that, you know, the first two acts in this movie spent so much time and effort on.
Yeah, when I'm thinking about the plot of this movie, I'm trying to think, like, where did it kind of go wrong? And there was a couple things that it did wrong, but I would say the single worst thing that they did was when they handed off the bad guy character from the guy whose name was Rowan North, who was kind of like the Janos of this movie. He's basically like a remake of the Ghostbusters 2 character, who didn't work in Ghostbusters 2, so I don't know why you would remake it in this movie. But when they handed off from Janos 2.0 to Chris Hemsworth, and they made him the new bad guy, like, yeah, that was such a bizarre handoff. And all of a sudden, he started acting completely out of character. He was into dancing and weightlifting. He kept talking about how great it is to be strong. It's like, hey, moron, like, people don't work out to be strong. Like, if you want to be strong, gain 500 pounds. Like, you know, eat like a maniac. Like, people work out because you look good when you take pictures. Like, that's why you work out. It's not about strength, moron. That's ridiculous.
Chris Hemsworth is, you know, working out because, number one, he gets paid for it. Number two, his vanity drives him. You know, like, that's why I go and work out. My vanity drives me, because I'm not even making money off of being, you know, fit and in shape anymore. It's my vanity that pushes me to work out. That's why everybody does it. But you know, to that point, yeah. I think you made a good point, and you said this movie kind of lost its place, lost its way when they went into the mayor's office. And I thought once they went into the mayor's office, they were going to do something interesting, which is
I gotta pause you, because I actually, what I said was, I missed that scene because I went to go get a refill of my drink. Like, what happened in the mayor's office? I didn't understand the whole mayor plot line because I missed the first scene of it. I need somebody to tell me what happened.
So it was a weird introduction, because it just comes out of kind of nowhere, and it's a little perplexing. But what they do is, they get called, and it's kind of a recreation of the first scene in Ghostbusters when they meet Slimer and they kind of catch their first ghost. And that is, they get a call, and it's like, hey, there's this ghost that's on the loose, you know, and we need you to come in and bust it before it causes a lot of problems for this Ozzy Osbourne rock show that we have, because we need to shoehorn in Ozzy Osbourne for some strange fucking reason. But
that was bizarre.
Yeah. And it also leads to, like, the worst cameo in the whole film of just, hey, remember how odd and weird Ozzy is whenever he speaks because he's done so many drugs? Here's a little reminder of that. Okay, now back to the movie. But so they go in and they bust this ghost. And it kind of is this whole moment to where it's just like, you know, before people were questioning whether or not the Ghostbusters were for real, or were they frauds, are ghosts real? And then now it's like all these thousands of people have seen it, and it kind of, you know, it touches a little bit on, like, the power of social media and how that kind of legitimizes something and kind of brings something into the public zeitgeist. And then immediately after that, they get called into the mayor's office, and the mayor's not a character that we've met before. And I'm thinking, like, okay, they've got Andy Garcia. Maybe they're going to do something with Andy Garcia. And instead, like, it's just this whole thing of, like, hey, here's some, you know, bizarrely comedic scenes with Andy Garcia. And now we kind of introduce a hurdle to the Ghostbusters that just doesn't become a hurdle at all. You know, the mayor's office is like, hey, good job catching that ghost. In order to preserve something, we have to expose you guys as being frauds. We need you guys to play along with it. All right, thanks, goodbye.
Was Andy Garcia playing the part like as if he was really stupid?
He wasn't portrayed like as somebody who was very, you know, intellectual. It was more just kind of like it was this vague reference to some kind of conspiracy to like it was this kind of like X-Files sort of thing. Of, you know, it was a dumbed down version of like the Smoking Man, to where it's like, well, you know, we can't really expose people to the truth, and we know that you know the truth, but you have to play along with this because otherwise we'll just crush you. And it was really weird because
like
they sort of made it pay off at the end of the movie, but it feels like that's maybe something that they should have had pay off much earlier in the movie. They needed to do one of two things with it, which is they either needed to kind of bribe the mayor's office into giving them whatever they need, which would have made so much more fucking sense had they had it happen in the second act of the film, or they needed to make it more adversarial to where the mayor's office, like they needed to have kind of that Walter Peck kind of thing. And an idea that I have about that is I think they should have had Melissa McCarthy play the mayor. And they should have had Melissa McCarthy be kind of adversarial there. Or they should have had Melissa McCarthy take Cicely Strong's role, which she was the mayor's assistant. And Melissa McCarthy should have been the person who was secretly running everything as the mayor's assistant. And they could have kept Andy Garcia and kept him as kind of like this dumb, like, you know, talking head. But had it been like, hey, Melissa McCarthy runs things, and she's going to shut you guys down. She's the Walter Peck of this movie. But instead, it was like, you know, hey, I'm playing a caricature rather than an actual character, and it wasn't that good.
What seemed really odd to me was that it almost felt like the mayor was unable to speak for himself, and there was that girl. You just said her name, but I don't have it memorized.
Cicely Strong. She's also an SNL cast member.
Yeah, I do recognize her from SNL. I just didn't know her name. But it seemed like she was kind of speaking for the mayor, like he couldn't speak for himself. Is that how it came across?
It was almost sort of like, yeah, the mayor, like, they made it seem like the mayor was maybe, like, whacked out. Like, he was, like, he kind of had the Ozzy Osbourne thing happen to him, to where, like, you know, his name was actually, you know, more important than he actually was. He didn't seem like he was all there. And so Cicely Strong had to, like, her character had to translate everything to them and be like, hey, so we're going to ruin you guys. But you guys have to be okay with it, and these are the reasons why. So, you know, no debate. You guys just kind of have to accept things. And it was weird because, again, it was like you take some people that are talented and you just underutilize what their skills are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hold on. I made some notes here. I want to refer to my notes for just 1 second, and I want to say that. When it came to the original Ghostbusters, there was a couple things that they did that really played well. Like it, the things that really captured the lightning in a bottle were the way that they made it seem like the real world. Like in this movie, you had that whole rock and roll scene that we were just talking about where the ghost was there. It's like if there was really a ghost at a rock concert, a big scary goat ghost like that, people would react to it by running away, terrified.
No. I think they actually played that really well. Although I think it would have been a lot better if they would have had a whole scene where like people realized it wasn't just a special effect and everyone gets freaked out and runs away. And I think when they start shooting their proton packs, like I think at first like people need like you need to have this whole confusion of people being like, "Oh, is this part of the show? Man, this is awesome. Like I didn't bargain for this at all." And I think you know, had they kind of played out this moment to where, like, you have this in the original Ghostbusters, where they start shooting stuff and then it starts creating damage and you realize, like, people's lives are actually in danger, you need to have a moment to where, like, people actually see that, react to it, and panic, rather than just kind of setting up a selfie joke, which is, selfie jokes are so bad, and they're just going to get worse with age. Like years on down the line, when, like, you know, selfie jokes are a punchline, yeah. You know, people are going to see that, and they're going to be like, ugh, and just groan and roll their eyes, because it's the same fucking joke every single time. Like, there's nothing new that you're doing with it that's going to make people be like, oh, that's a fucking classic, you know? Like you nailed it. Like, instead, it's just kind of like, oh, the joke is that somebody wants to take a selfie. Ha ha. It's not fucking funny. Like, it's not original. It's not creative. Like, you're not doing anything intelligent. It's fucking as dumb as the act of stopping to take a selfie itself is. It's stupid.
Right. But I actually really liked that the rock scene. Like, I liked how they were using all the jargon of the Ghostbusters. They all had the proton pack. It had all those cool sound effects. It had them, like, working as a team. You know, they captured the ghosts. Like, that was the most, like, traditional ghostbusting scene, and I thought it was, like, the best scene.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, you do have to have that, like, something that they did so well in the original Ghostbusters, where, actually, you if you look at it correctly, Walter Peck was not a bad guy in that movie. I know he was an adversary for the Ghostbusters, and therefore, you know, that made him a protagonist in the film. But Walter Peck was just like, hey, these guys are walking around with unregulated nuclear accelerators on their backs. Like, they're not only putting themselves at risk, they're putting millions of people at risk. Like this could cause the destruction of New York City. The actual response to the threat is far more dangerous than the threat itself, until you get to Gozer. And that needed to be, like, the whole, like, you needed to have this whole reaction of people to where they realize, like, the Ghostbusters are dangerous and they're afraid of the Ghostbusters. Like, that needs to be sort of the hurdle that the Ghostbusters overcome. Not just the mayor's office is like, well, yeah, but, you know, people can't know too much, you know. The truth is out there and you have to help us cover it up. Like that was just so just confusing, you know. I think it muddled things to a point to where you could have, like, clarified things so much better by kind of having, I mean, if you're just going to fucking remake that movie, why don't you have the Walter Peck character in the movie? Like, that makes sense. There's a reason why the first film had that, and that would make sense why the remake would have it.
Yeah, see, I love the Walter Peck character, but I was kind of wrestling with this issue myself. Like, would I want to see his character come back in this movie? And I feel like I get why you would leave it out, but ultimately it's weaker without him. I think it's a lose-lose situation. Like, you don't want to put him in there because you don't want to copy the first movie, but without that character in there, it's just, where is the substance of the adversarial aspect of it? You know, and I mean, they try to recreate the adversarialness through that bad guy who's going out and planning all those ghost creating devices or those ghost amplifying devices.
Yeah, which is really weird. And when they reference later on that, like, oh, he's using the same science that we are, you know, that was an opportunity missed of, like, well, I guess they kind of connected it by saying, like, oh, he went out and got your book. But it's also something to where it's like, maybe you could have set something up to where it's like, at one point he did try to reach out to Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig's character, to Gilbert and Tate or whatever her name was, you know, and say, like, oh, here's somebody that he tried to reach out to you guys. And maybe Kristen Wiig's character, because she was trying to distance herself from that, maybe she just kind of, like, shat on him. And she's like, no, this is stupid. They're not real. Like, it's dumb to believe in them. You know, that's maybe a scene that you should have had in the film, rather than Ed Begley Jr. walking up and, like, you have this weird, like, awkward moment. Like, to me, it was more awkward than it was funny, and I realized, like, sometimes people try to mine for comedy by saying, like, hey, here's this awkward position that we're putting the character in. Ha ha ha, isn't it funny how uncomfortable they are? But, yeah, you could have had something there to where, like, you know, maybe that was his motivation, instead of having his motivation be, you know, the Peter Parker in Spider-Man 3 emo motivation of, like, ooh, I don't like people because they're mean and they're rude. And it's like, well, yeah, like people treat you like you're a fucking a weird goon because you're a fucking weird goon. You walk around talking to yourself like you're awkward. Like, and the thing is about that, it's like, maybe in 1985, like, it would have made sense of, like, people ostracizing a person like that. But, like, nowadays, that just makes you a fucking hipster, you know? Like, if you're just, like, kind of the weird guy that, like, you know, doesn't like groups of people, like, he would have found, through the internet and through other sources, he would have found his own group of people, you know? Instead of being like, oh, I need to destroy the world. It's like, you know who wants to destroy the world? Like, fucking religious extremists. Like that would have made more sense if he's like,
oh, yeah, I would have liked that.
Yeah, like if he was just like, if he like held on to like some tenet of Christianity or some other religion and said like, oh, well, the world is naughty and it must be like punished, and like that's why I'm trying to bring out the dead in order to like punish it. Because like that's kind of the thing, is like if you go back and you watch the first Ghostbusters, it's like, who's the actual you know, antagonist of the film? And it's like, you have Walter Peck, but then it becomes like Gozer, and it's like, I mean, who is trying to bring Gozer into the world?
Well, they kind of hand off the adversarialness like a couple of times. Like they give it to Dana when she becomes a ghost, and she's Zool. She's a little adversarial. Rick Moranis is a little adversarial at one point. Walter Peck is. The mayor is at one point, then Zool is towards the end.
Yeah,
and also the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
And that's something that is like, the execution of that movie is so good that you don't notice that there actually isn't a clear antagonist in the movie. That the actual antagonist is just a series of events. That there's this you know, energy that is picking up momentum and kind of creating its own occurrence rather than being someone that's driving it, which is what you had in Ghostbusters 2. In Ghostbusters 2, you know, the main problem with that is you don't have a strong antagonist. Like, you have Janusz, who gets kind of compelled to bring about the bad guy's name in that movie.
I know the answer to this.
Jorg the Carpathian. Viggo the Carpathian.
Viggo, yeah.
Yeah. So for some reason, Viggo suddenly gains enough strength to possess a person, and he possesses Janusz. And it's so weird, because it's like, in this movie, you know, Rowan is kind of this weird... He has this weird resemblance to Janusz.
Oh, yeah.
But instead of, like, making him an ethnic stereotype, they just make him, like, oh, he's a weirdo. And because he's a weirdo, that's why he's a bad guy. And that makes no fucking sense, and it's so dishonest.
Yeah. I do have to make a side note that, like, every white guy in the movie is either, like, retarded or a bad guy. I just have to throw that out there.
Yeah, that is a good point, because even with Chris Hemsworth, you know...
he's a retard.
Yeah, he's a retard. And it's funny, though, because what they are is they're doing a twist on sort of the blonde bimbo role.
Yeah, of course. It's very obvious that they're doing that.
Yeah, which is something... It's something they could have easily...
You can't get offended at this because you've done this a million times to girl characters.
Exactly, exactly. It's like, if it's fair to do it this way, then it's fair for us to do it that way. And again,
yeah, but see,
you know...
But the problem with that, though, is it's not fair to do that to girls anymore. And so basically you're having a comment on something that they did 30 years ago to female characters.
No, this is something that's still occurring to this day.
Oh, well, if it is, I denounce and reject it.
I mean, it's something that, like, when you do it now, it's kind of like, hey, not cool. Like, people are much more hyper aware of it. But, right. I mean, I think it is fair grounds for them to sit there and say, like, hey, you know, here's this. And if you've got a problem with us doing this... then you should have a problem with the fact that this is the way that it was done, you know, to female characters, you know, in the whole history of Hollywood before this.
Yeah. Well, see, I do have a problem with both. So where does that put me?
No, I mean, it's fair for you to have a problem with both. But what I'm saying is it's dishonest for someone to say, well, I have a problem with them doing it with Chris Hemsworth, but I don't have a problem with them doing it with fucking Goldie Hawn, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, and they were very obviously like making a comment about sexism, but the comment, it seemed like they drug the joke out like too long, too far, too hard. It was like to the point where when he's standing downstairs and he's like, I want to be a Ghostbuster. Yeah, I've got my bicycle here. I've got my motorbike. I want to be a Ghostbuster. And he was just acting so stupid.
Well, and that's the problem is if you're going to do that, you can't also sit there and make that person one of the main characters of your film and then expect that character to work and to be able to like have different levels to the problem with that is you made Chris Hemsworth a prop, but then you still like kept that prop and expected people to buy it as an actual real person who's a real member of your cast. And it's like you're trying to have it both ways. It doesn't work. He either needs to be a prop or he needs to be made a full character. And that's one of the big flaws of this movie is that it has so few actual real characters that are relatable that, you know, it does make the movie much more two-dimensional than it intends to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like when you take a character like that, there's him that's real two-dimensional, and then also the bad guy, Rowan North, is real two-dimensional.
Yeah, and I think Rowan should have been part of a cult. And I think that's an opportunity to make it less of like, you know, hey, here's a man and he's bad and he's dumb and his motivations and intentions are bad and dumb, you know, and like I don't think they were trying to make that a reflection of like, you know, hey, we're anti-men, we're anti-meninist. But that's how it can be perceived. And if it can be twisted and perceived, like that's a failure on the part of the filmmakers more so than it is something that, you know, is an unfair play by the people who are criticizing it. You know, I think if you make Rowan part of a cult that is trying to bring about the destruction, and that's because they're driven more by their sort of religious extremism as opposed to just like, oh, I've been ostracized and victimized and this is how I'm gonna get back at you guys. Like that's not like what happens with terrorists. Like terrorists like do the sorts of things that Rowan was doing. Like if you sit there and change it, and instead of him leaving ghost devices, he's leaving fucking crockpot bombs like the Boston bombers, you know.
Yeah.
Then it's like it makes much more sense if you're like, oh, he's driven by religious extremism, which was the motivation for the Boston bombers. They weren't motivated by the fact that they got fucking picked on and bullied. Like those kids were actually popular. They were actually well liked. But religious extremism drove them to a point to where they were willing to actually hurt people and destroy people's lives because they felt like there is something that compelled them to do that, you know? And instead, well, like, you have him, like, I don't know, he's, like, this sort of character like the Aurora Theater shooter. He's like, people are. But I mean, even with that person was clearly mentally ill, like obviously mentally ill. And with Rowan, it's just like he's a dick because people were a dick to him. And it's just like, why would he go to such? I mean, clearly the guy must be fucking brilliant if he can build these devices that can cross over into another dimensional plane and then draw spiritual beings. Like this guy's a fucking brilliant genius. But for some reason, he's just like, I'm the fucking janitor at a hotel, and I don't like people because they're mean. It's so dumb. It's so bad. Like that's something to where it's just like, you know, when we talk about taking those ingredients and trying to create, like, a really delicious meal out of them, you used a bad, rotten ingredient in it. Like, you fucking, you're like, oh, you know what I'm going to put in this pasta? Durian. Durian fucking stinks and is gross.
Well, I want to say in defense of like this movie and any movie, it's like you don't really know what is going to taste good until you kind of make the whole movie. You know, that's why you should just make different movies, and the ones that work, those are the ones that you sequelize. But reboots, you get this terrible mix of you're trying to make an all new movie, but you're also trying to reboot something, and you don't really have a sense of what works and what doesn't work because you've never made a version like this that works.
Yeah, but I mean, you're talking about Paul Feig, and you're talking about I forget the name of the woman who co-wrote the movie with him, but these weren't inexperienced people. These were people who should have known what they were doing, and then this is what they came up with. And you know, again, it's not a bad movie, but it's not a great movie. And you know,
well, if like you, Janos, if you can... he was a religious extremist. It's just his religion was worshiping Vigo, the painting.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, he was also somebody that his actions were driven because he was he got possessed by Vigo's spirit.
Oh yeah,
you know. But I mean, that's sort of the thing that, like, whenever people want to make fun of Ghostbusters 2, one of the best ways to kind of expose the flaws of that movie is, okay, let's say that Viggo the Carpathian's plan actually works. Like, what does he do then? Like, he's a baby now. Like, if you allow Viggo to do what he wants to do, he becomes a baby. And then it's like, you have less power as a fucking baby than you do as a painting that can sit there and possess a full-grown man. It's like, why don't you just possess a full-grown man? Like, when he possesses Dan Aykroyd, when he possesses Ray Stantz, it's like, okay, like, you can sit there and use the proton packs and kill the other Ghostbusters. You can do so much more possessing that man's body than you can possessing that fucking baby's body. What is that baby gonna do? Grow up to be Hitler? And it's like, at one point, Viggo the Carpathian, like he was an actual ruler and he died. Like, you know, he didn't take over the world. So how is he gonna take over the world as a baby? Like, it doesn't make any fucking sense if you think about it.
Manny, you're ranting again.
I know. But that's the thing, is that, like that kind of shows you, if you sit there and say, like, oh, okay, like in the first Ghostbusters, you understand what the stakes are. If Gozer is able to come into our world and destroy our world, like, it creates a being that we have no ability to fight. And the only way to stop it is to close that gate. And that's exactly what they do. And if they were to fail at that, like, you now have an unstoppable monster that's in our world just going around destroying everything. You know, as dumb as a movie like Pacific Rim is, you understand what the stakes are. And it's like, if they're able to, like, send these monsters into our world, it can just go around causing complete and absolute death and destruction. And we don't have any way to combat that. But with this, it's just like, all right, he's going to bring Ghost. And, I mean, the ghosts aren't even killing people. Like the ghosts make, what's his face, is from The Office, the guy that's on... the guy at the very beginning of the film. Like, I thought that guy either got killed or got possessed, but instead...
Oh, he's from The Office? I remember him from...
Well, he's also on Silicon Valley.
Yeah, Silicon Valley.
But, yeah, he was in, like, season 6 of The Office.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
But, yeah, he's Jared from Silicon Valley. And, like, you
yes,
know...
Yes, that's where I know him from, Silicon Valley. He's great in that.
I was kind of confused when I saw him at the beginning, like after the cold open of the film. I was like, is he possessed now? And it was like, no, he's normal. And he didn't get killed. The only thing that it did was make him shit his pants. And then when they confront the ghost...
That was weird to me, too. I noticed that, too, because they implied that he got killed, basically.
Yeah, and, like, this is a ghost of, like, someone who's supposed to be, like super evil. But it's like, what does she do? She makes one guy shit his pants... and then she throws up on Kristen Wiig, kind of it, you know? And even when they're fighting the ghost, like, at the end of the movie,
weird.
It's like, what are the ghosts doing? The ghosts, like, they're not killing people. They're just doing fucking, like, you know, they're doing battle with the ghost. It's so weird. It doesn't make any sense. It's like, what's the actual threat here?
Well, even the Janos character in this one even said that they're just going to pester the living.
Well, he says that they're going to, like, torment the living and stuff like that. And, like, she has kind of a funny line. She's like, oh, that doesn't sound good at all. It's like, yeah, but what's the threat? Like nothing happens to anybody. And part of that is, like, yeah, I realize it's a PG-13 movie. You can't show, like... you know, violence up to a certain level, which is so dumb. Like, it's so dumb when you neuter movies like that. What they need to do is, like, the way that you can, like, go and you can say, like, okay, do I want to watch the 2D presentation? Do I want to watch the 3D presentation? Do I want to watch the IMAX 3D presentation? You know, they need to have, like, okay, do I want to watch the PG-13 version of the film or do I want to watch the R-rated version of the film? Like, that's what you need to do. You need to make an R-rated version of the film, and then you need to go back and re-edit that so that you can have a PG version of the film. Because, man, so many of these, like, big blockbuster movies that are, like, action spectacles, you know, and these comic book movies, Like, when you make a PG-13 movie, like, ultimately it's just lame and dumb, you know? Like, if you can't show, like violent things happening to people, but you need to have it be a threat in your movie, you know, it just makes it lame. It makes it uninteresting to watch when it's just like, oh, you know, like, supposedly people can get killed, but nobody's getting killed. I'm not seeing anybody get killed.
Yeah, they're so terrified to be offensive to people that it sucks. Yeah. It's like there's always going to be somebody offended for some stupid
But yet,
reason.
When you actually do say, you know what, fuck it. We're going to show a movie where there's violence, there's blood, there's death. Like there's bad shit happening to people. But we're also going to make it, like, fun and kind of slapstick. We're going to make an action comedy with actual real violence. You have Deadpool, which makes a ton of fucking money. You know, yeah. And that was a movie to where, like, they were so handcuffed by the budget, and yet still they managed to make it work. And it's because, like, hey, you know what? We're going to make smart decisions. And when you have something like this where you're like, hey, we have a huge budget, you know, we have a huge marketing campaign that we know is most likely going to get people to come and watch this movie. Plus, we have a whole, like, controversy that's getting people to talk about this movie, to where you're almost guaranteed, like, a certain level of success. It's like, you can't just get lazy and, like, sit back and be like, oh, we'll have a PG-13 movie. Because I can tell you, like, that was one of the things when I watched Dark Knight Rises. That scene when, like, supposedly, like, they massacre a bunch of the cops toward the end of the movie, it took me completely out of the movie, because I was like, they're supposed to be dead, but it's just actors laying on the ground. There's no bullet holes in the body. Nobody's bloody. I didn't see anybody die. I just saw everyone standing there, and they cut to, like, kill them all, and they pull the triggers on their guns, but I don't see anybody getting shot. I don't see anybody actually dying. You know, I'm just getting the illusion of death and destruction. And there's no real weight to that. There's no real power to that. And that's exactly the problem with that movie, yeah. With this movie, with the Avengers movies, you know, with the Superman movies, the Superman versus Batman movies. It's like, I don't see anybody actually getting killed. I don't see anybody actually dying. There's nothing for me to care about, because none of this is real. Like, I can see more shit happen in a video game to where it's like, oh, wow, like that's a violent way to kill somebody. You know, and it makes you kind of think about that. And, like, even if you're not, like, bothered by it, you're at least getting kind of the visceral experience of, like, well, what happens, you know, if this, you know, if I walk into this bomb, what happens to my character? And it's like, oh, shit, like, you know, I'm actually experiencing something that I'm not going to get in real life, because I'm not going to walk into an actual bomb.
Yeah, and also I'm trying to think about the plot of this movie right now. And I'm trying to think about, what did you think about the part where all of a sudden Holtzman became like Q from James Bond, basically, where she was just presenting them this like platter of all these new weapons. So it's like, oh, now you've got this weapon, now you've got this weapon, now you've got this weapon.
Yeah, I mean,
it seemed like they were trying to like make a sequel inside the movie. It's like, here's where we up the stakes of everything and completely change the way all the weapons work.
Yeah.
I thought that was super
well, and
bizarre.
here's two problems with that. Number one is, you know, it's not something like I didn't feel like they earned that. I didn't feel like they showed like Holtzman like really, you know, working to kind of perfect the science to make it work. It was just sort of like her character is the science person. Oh, hey, look, I figured out how to make new weapons because that's my role in this movie. So that was a real problem. The other problem I have here's how you improve this movie is they had a great sequence when they get fired from the shitty university and they get kicked out. Like the whole part when he starts off and he's like, I didn't even know you guys were still a department. Like, that's funny. Like, they're like, okay, that's why they have like all this freedom to do stuff is because they got lost in the shuffle. And then when they show them like running away with all the equipment, like, that's also kind of funny because, like, you have the reaction of Kristen Wiig's character, Aaron Gilbert, which is like, wait a minute, you guys aren't supposed to have this stuff? You stole this? And they're like, yeah, everyone scatter, run in different directions. You can't catch all of us. That's funny because you realize there's a consequence. Like, if he catches them, not only is he going to beat them with that bat, but also they lose this equipment that they kind of need to start up their business. And I feel like one way that you could have improved the comedy of this movie is whether you do it in a montage or whether you keep going back to this scene of them breaking into that university and stealing equipment that they need in order to refine their proton packs and their ghost-catching traps. But you never have that. You just magically, they have new equipment. Even though they're producing no income, they've all gotten fired from their jobs. So it's like, where are they getting this fucking money from? You know? And that was another thing. And again, you know, they put it at the end of the movie when it needed to be in the second half of the movie, which is they bribe the mayor's office into giving them whatever they need. And, like, that's when you should have had Holtzman say, like, hey, now that we have funding from the city, like, here is what I've done with that. And I've created this new equipment and I've made these adjustments and everything works better now. And we have new stuff. Instead, it was just kind of like, well, they need something to that we can then reuse in the finality of the film. So here, she's just going to give it to him. Like, none of that is earned. And, like, I know, like, most people watching the film probably won't even think about that or even care. But for someone like me that thinks about story and kind of thinks about how in the real world a person gets from A to B to C to D, like, I'm just like, how did they get any of that? Like, you're talking about scientific equipment that doesn't exist right now, but I'm supposed to believe that not only do they have this, but they don't even have, like, a whole lab. They don't have a team of people that are working on this. They don't even have, like, a way to actually test this stuff out in a safe environment. It's just, oh, yeah, hey, this thing works, and, no consequences, you know? Like...
Well, I don't have the exact same opinion because, like, there was one reference to where she said, "I printed out a new circuit board," which is saying that she's got the small piece of equipment it would take to print a circuit board, and then all you have to do is, you know, design something in a computer, print the circuit board for it. You know, maybe she has a 3D printer. Like, I don't think her creating some of the technology would cost a boatload of money, but, like, there was something that really struck me about the engineering of the Ghostbuster weapons, and it got me kind of thinking about how the original weapons worked. I wanted to kind of get your opinion of this. Like, you know, we have no idea if any of this stuff would work. Most likely it would not work, of course. Ghosts aren't even real, so what am I even talking about? But the way the proton pack works is it's a, you know, nuclear accelerator, which is just a way of saying it creates a lot of energy, because you would need a lot of electricity to do whatever that thing is doing. And then the way it looks on camera is essentially like a lightning bolt coming out of the holster. It's like a gun, like a shotgun or like a Gatling gun kind of style, and a lightning bolt comes out of it. And the effect that the lightning bolt has is that it latches onto a ghost.
In our
primitive human brains, like, that makes enough sense, because we combine the idea of a lightning bolt. We know how a lightning bolt works, how damaging it is. And then you presuppose that it can connect to the ghost, and that's how it works.
Yeah, and what makes
and that's it's like a
what makes this
thing.
Stuff work is it's just for fun and entertainment. Within this universe, they're weaponizing science, and, you know, again, like, the whole premise of the original film and of the entire Ghostbusters universe is they're exterminators for ghosts. And, like, you're mining that for comedy, which is a smart thing to do, you know. But again, with this, like what works so well in original Ghostbusters, and you hit on this really well, was, you know it's bullshit science. You know you're trying to meld two things that don't really fit together, which is the paranormal with scientific approach and experimentation, but they do such a good job in that original film of explaining, like, hey, this is how, you know. Like this does this and that does that, and when you combine these things together, this is how they work. And, like, it's bullshit. It's all completely made up, but they do an effective job of selling it to you, which is something that they fail at in the sequel, Ghostbusters 2, because they try to talk about mood slime, but it's just like, hey, we got this thing that we need to sell to kids that we have to shoehorn into the movie, so here's this whole thing that we kind of invented for it. It's kind of like in the movie Thank You for Smoking, when they say, like, well, hey, you can't smoke in space because it would cause everything to blow up because of the concentrated oxygen levels. And they go, no. All you got to do is put in a line of, thank God we invented this so that now we can smoke in space. And that's what this shit is.
And can I point out that that was directed by Ivan Reitman's
Jason
son,
Reitman. Jason yeah. Reitman. And it's not a great film, but it's a pretty good film. And the best part of it is
totally
how it lampoons Hollywood
fantastic
itself.
Film.
Like, I love that.
Thank You for Smoking is a fantastic film. I'm going to officially disagree with you on that point. Let me also say, though, but when they started creating the new weapons, I ended up thinking a lot about this. And they had one weapon where it was like a ghost grenade. You throw a grenade and it blows the ghost up. Okay, that doesn't jive with how the Ghostbuster technology works. It doesn't jive with the idea that ghosts can't be killed. Of course ghosts can't be killed. If they could be killed, like, they're already dead. Like, you can't kill them. That's
Which
silly.
Is
like,
why it doesn't make any sense why they have a fight scene with the ghost at the end. It's like you're actually watching, like, the bodies of the ghost. I think if you would have kind of explained it more like, okay, what they're doing is they're taking something that exists on a spiritual plane, and the way that all of Rowan's technology works is he actually gives it a real physical being in this world, and so they have to create stuff that can actually, like, combat them on that level. Like, that makes sense, and I think that's kind of what they're trying to do, but they never explained, like, they never made it so overt that you're like, oh, okay, that's why. That, like, they didn't do a good job of explaining the rules in their own world that they created, but that's something that they did so effectively in the first Ghostbusters film, and that's why they were able to get away with so much bullshit in Ghostbusters 2, was because you went into Ghostbusters 2 understanding how Ghostbusters 1 worked, and the rules, you were like, okay, the rules just carry over. But then when you reboot the whole thing, you're like, okay, well, is it the same rules from the first one? Which, in this universe, that film no longer exists, and those actors are no longer their same characters, you know? And that's another flaw, and that's another failure of this film.
Yeah. I was going to do a quick list of all the new weapons and how I didn't like them all, though, real fast. The other new weapon that they made was one where Kate McKenna was able to, like, latch onto the ghost, and it had, like, a whip effect where she could, like, whip the ghost.
Yeah, she turns herself into Whiplash from Iron Man 2.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense, just because that's not how those weapons work. Like, when you keep redefining how they work over and over and over, it becomes confusing, and you can't, like, follow the logic of it. And then the other one was where you punch the ghost, and that seemed to me like that was a setup for something that never got paid off. Is that my imagination? Or did they pay that off?
It seems like that one thing, I know that they did use it in the ghost fight, but it seems like it only existed so that they could have that joke about Kristen Wiig trying to high five her and being like, "Oh, that's a deadly high five," which is something they showed in the trailer, which was not a funny moment at all. It's not anywhere near as funny as anybody making that film thought it was.
No, it was not very funny. I totally agree with you there. And just the idea that you're going to make all these new weapons, it really seemed to be, to me, like it was more a reference to that Ghostbusters video game that came out a couple of years ago. Did you play that?
No, but I watched the gameplay of it, and, you know, unofficially, that's Ghostbusters 3. And it did have the original cast, and everybody really liked it for that reason, and because it was good, and it was fun, you know, and it made sense, and, you know, it was something that was like, right from the start, they're like, hey, you understand the rules of how the Ghostbusters universe works? Okay, great. As long as you know that, then everything that we do will make sense to you.
Well, in a video game, it's important to get new weapons.
Yeah, you got to upgrade because you continuously, like, there's an increase in the, you know, potency of your enemies, so you have to have, you know, a weapon that addresses that. Like, you have to level it out to your character's advantage.
Yeah, but it doesn't work the same way in a movie, and they seem to be using, like, the video game logic for the movie. It was, like, halfway through the movie they decided, okay, now this is the sequel to the first movie. It was almost like it was split into two halves, and it was divided right at that point where Holtzman, like, broke out all these new weapons. Like, I like it when she says, I upgraded this weapon by adding this, this, and this. Like, I like that. But when she's going to say, oh, I made a whole platter of new weapons today, it's like, that's silly.
Well, and here's where the people that are offended by the notion that they made a new Ghostbusters and they don't care what the gender of the cast members is, just the fact that it's not actually, you know, the original cast members. And here's where they have a good point is, you know, it just this new film kind of just throws all of that out of the window. And it says, like, look, we don't care, like, you know, what it was about the first film that worked for you. We just are using the property and, you know, we're taking advantage of the fact that you have fond memories of the property, and we're going to basically, like, you know, we're going to exploit that. And that's exactly what they were doing. They were exploiting that and saying, like, hey, you know, you like that first film, and we're going to make some vague references back to it, but, you know, we're not going to actually do anything to really energize and capitalize on that. But hey, I need to wrap this up. I got someone else trying to get in touch with me.
Okay. All right. Well, that's been Sequelitis for this week. Thanks for listening.
Bye.